This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of experts discusses the Utah real estate frenzy and its impact on rural Utahns. Over the last year, 22 of Utah's 29 counties experienced increases in housing prices. Salt Lake County, the state's most urban and populous, sold 17,000 homes alone. While this is a slower market than 2020, real estate experts say that home appreciation will continue through 2022. But this growth is not just happening in Utah's Wasatch Front, but across the state, rural communities are seeing rising home prices and strains on their infrastructure and water usage. Today's panel gets into the causes of these market forces, their impacts on Utah, and some possible immediate and long-term solutions to housing scarcity. Included on the panel is Jim Wood, Ivory Boyer Senior Fellow at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute, Ben Riley, Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Southeastern Utah, and Pat Matheson, Executive Director of the Mountainlands Community Housing Trust. Moderating today's discussion will be Morgan Lynn Cotty, Associate Director of the Hinckley Institute. This forum was put on in partnership with the Salt Lake Chamber. This forum was recorded on November 15th, 2021. Here is your moderator, Morgan Lynn Cotty.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We know this is a really important topic that a lot of people really care about. So we're excited to hear what our wonderful panel has to say. So, Jim, I'd like to start with you. The Gardner Policy Institute recently published their State of the State on Housing. And just tell us what's happening. Tell us about some of these trends.
Well, the market is really in an unusual state right now, I would say. I've studied the market for a number of years, and this current period is different than all of the other cycles that I've lived through, going back probably more than four decades, 40 years plus. And how is it different? One, it is statewide. And that is in terms of price increases and housing shortage. And two, it's affecting both types of tenure, that is home ownership as well as renters. So it's a difficult market for statewide in almost every county. The only exceptions would be out in the Uinta Basin, where they were have been hurt by COVID due to the energy issues. But elsewhere throughout the state, it's a very difficult time for those trying to get into housing, whether it's renters or owners. And housing prices we haven't seen anything like what we've seen over the last 7 or 8 years, and particularly the last 12 months.
Thank you. And Ben, let's go to you next. You are our expert, our friend down in Moab. So what are you seeing in rural Utah, especially in Grand County and the Moab area?
Sure. I mean, kind of to echo what Jim was saying, our issue is just very low supply. And over the last 2, 3, 4 years, we've had a lot of development, but a lot of that development has been in overnight accommodation, commercial development, hotels, Airbnbs, condos, things like that. You know, most of you have been down here, I'm sure, have seen it. We're a small community. We don't have a huge pool of contractors and developers. And, you know, besides the Housing Authority and maybe a couple other very, very small organizations, there's just not a lot of people developing a single family homes or multifamily rentals. So when you have all of your pool of contractors and developers doing just commercial, just condos, because that's where the money is, you see a shortage of on supply. And now we're, you know, we're getting affected just by everyone else with the Zoom boom and second home. You know, you see that all over the place. So lots of factors affecting our supply, mainly, you know, we're down to probably 10, 12 houses for sale in Moab, probably currently, and they're all over, you know, $500,000. So definitely outside of what a service industry worker can afford, and even essential workers, police, hospital workers, park service, things like that.
And maybe before we jump to Pat, paint that bigger picture for us. Where are those service workers? Where are the people who make Moab, Moab, and make it so people from not just all over the state, but the country and the world can come to Moab and enjoy it? All the people that make that function, where are they living right now?
You know, that's a great question. And I don't have a very good answer for you, because it's really, you know, I think we're seeing what a lot of other resort communities see, people being packed into houses and doubling up. And, you know, certainly all of our affordable rentals are full. All of our, most of our single family houses are full. And, but that's what we're seeing, is that we have these, Moab only has a population of about 6,000, but that doubles, triples of, you know, residents, but not full-time residents, what the census would call them. So, you know, it's hard to get those type of people into, you know, our affordable rentals that are, you know, we try to get year-long leases and things like that. So, you know, employers have had to be creative and start to produce their own employee housing, you know, people using RVs and things like that. I think the city has been a little lenient on employers using things like RVs in the back of the shop and things like that. But you see all these kind of creative solutions across the board that aren't really solutions.
Thank you. And Pat, I know this is something that you're working on as well. So much of that affordable housing, the attention goes into the suburban or the urban areas in our state. And I know you're working on this throughout the state. So talk a little bit of the broader picture of what's going on in Utah and what your group is doing to try to work on that affordable housing issue.
Yeah, thanks. Our group focuses primarily on Summit and Wasatch counties along the Wasatch Back. And we experienced some of the resort economics that Ben mentioned, the Zoom boom, huge demand for second homes now becoming primary residences in the Wasatch Back as people moved out of California, New York, other places, and move here permanently. And echo the same comments Ben had on staffing and local employers and finding folks who they can employ and in those jobs and where they're living. Yeah, they're bunking up, they're filling up all of the rental units that we have available, and then trying to find other alternatives. But just this last week in our local newspaper, there was a report on the big employers in the Wasatch Back expect to see huge, you know, gaps in employment over this next winter. They're not going to be able to fill all the positions, and it's going to impact their ability to serve their clients and so on and so forth. And that has ripple effects down the line. Another thing I would point out, so that's sort of the resort side of things. The small towns along the Wasatch Back, small cities, Francis, Camas, Oakley, Heber is no longer a small town, but you know, those areas in Wasatch County as well, have in the past been somewhat immune from the resort dynamics. It's crept up a little bit over time, but over these past 12 months, as Jim mentioned, these radical price increases recently have had such an impact on these smaller rural towns that the old strategies that we used to employ to produce housing in these areas might not work anymore, given the increase in prices. A quick example is that we used to be able to acquire lots for a mutual self-help program. I know Ben does mutual self-help in Grand County. And we used to be able to acquire lots in Summit County at $100,000 a lot, you know, less than that. 10 years ago, it was, you know, $50,000 a lot. You know, now we're competing against the biggest builders in the state and even national and regional builders, home builders. And we're competing for lots over $200,000 just for an improved lot. So we used to be able to make a certain program work with certain financing and certain restrictions when land was available at a certain price. And now that land is, you know, doubled in its value, we're going to have to find new means of creating affordable housing in these small rural towns in order to keep it affordable for locals.
Thank you. And both of you mentioned some of the influx of people, this sort of the Zoom boom, people moving statewide, coming from other states. I wonder if we can get Jim on this to talk a little bit about those demographic trends and just who are the people that are coming in and how does that affect the area economically and housing wise?
Well, that's a good question, Morgan. I just have to ask, though, from what Pat just said a minute ago, I'd like to ask him just one question on, does that mean Crown homes are out in your area?
Not Crown. I think that there are opportunities for Crown, and the real challenge is going to be mutual self-help. And the key difference there is in permanent affordability. The Crown also has a question about permanent affordability if you really want to get into the weeds. But at the end of the day, we are so lucky, and I feel so grateful that the Wasatch Back, the communities along the Wasatch Back, really support affordable housing. There's inclusionary zoning policies in place and that sort of thing. But anytime a municipality is going to require affordable housing as part of a new development, they're typically going to require permanence, right? They don't want the housing to be created once. And then after a certain number of years, 15 years, or sometimes even after just resale of the first owner, that permanence then goes away. Wow. And so what they're looking for is, some permanent affordability. So if we can find ways to do that with Crown or with mutual self-help, then I think that it could be a winning strategy again. But in the past, there haven't been those long-term restrictions. And so that limits the ability of working within the inclusionary zoning realm.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry, Morgan, I had to digress there.
No worries. That was an important question. I'm glad you asked it.
Yeah, we can talk about Crown later on. It's a really good program for rural Utah. But in terms of the migration and the Zoom boom, what we have really is just what Pat and Ben said. We have anecdotes. We don't have good data. If you look at the migration, the net in migration rates for the state, which come out of the governor's office's management budget, in fact, I've got them here. They show very little increase in this last year. We had 2020, we had 19,000 net in migration. In 2021, they estimate, these are estimates, migration is really a difficult number to come up with. We have 20,000. And then for 2022, 25,000. So maybe that 25,000 is capturing what Ben and Pat have mentioned. Past years, we've been as high running up to the Great Recession. Our net in migration was up well over 30,000, 35,000. So there's a little bit of a bump there, and that certainly could account for it. I hear the anecdotes often all over the state, in different markets. I was doing a project out in Roosevelt and unsolicited. The realtor said, we're having a Zoom boom out here in Roosevelt. Now, I don't know if they're coming from Salt Lake to Roosevelt or if they're out-of-staters, but we tried to get the board of the real estate board, mobile listing board, to survey new buyers as to where they were coming from. And we went through some hoops a year ago on that issue related to this question, because it comes up so often. And in the end, they determined that we could not do that because of confidentiality. They had some issues there. So we really don't know. There, one of the sources that the governor's office management budget would use would be tax records. And you can get some idea there, and also driver's license records. Getting new driver's license in Utah, and they've come from X, Y, or Z. But those are a bit dated right now. So unfortunately, we're left with the anecdotes. But one of the problems with anecdotes, they can get exaggerated pretty fast. And they're passed around. And by the time, I know in Summit County, I talked to Jeff Jones, and he just says it is quite an issue up there. They have hard evidence in terms of they know what's going on. But in Salt Lake County and statewide, less so. I don't know what down in Ben's county or area, if he's probably got on the ground experience with people who have actually done that. But again, those are pretty small numbers. When we're talking about a population, you know, of 3.2 million, net in migration of 20,000-25,000. But at this point, the jury's still out on that, Morgan. We really don't know. We're left with anecdotes.
Thank you. And I think we all have those. Everybody loves to talk about the Californians that have moved in on their street or who are building a home. So thank you. I appreciate you providing that perspective.
One comment there, Morgan. We were up in Idaho and driving outside of Twin Falls going north to Sun Valley. And one of the little towns out there just outside of Haley, they had a sign, "Welcome to California East." So, yeah. You know, it's just, it's going on, but how much, we're not sure.
Yeah, very interesting. I want to go back to something that Ben mentioned, just talking about how in rural Utah, in certain places, there's not as many builders, there's not as many contractors, all these sorts of things. Beyond even that, Ben and Pat, I'd love your perspective, because even very urban suburban areas are being hit by labor shortages and inflation and things that are making building more difficult. I'd love to hear perspectives on what's going on in rural areas that you focus on. Ben, let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to what you said, I mean, you know, certainly the price of material is something that we fight against. And being in rural Utah, I mean, we don't get the luxury of being over the hill from Salt Lake or being close to urban centers. So our price to build is, you know, that more, couple dollars more square foot, which makes it harder for us. And you couple that with the labor shortage that most general contractors are seeing and subcontractors are seeing. And it just makes prices go up all over the board. And so that's just something that we're fighting against, being rural and, you know, away from, you know, production material and cabinet material and all these things that, you know, it's a little bit easier to get if you live closer to an urban area.
Yeah, I would add to that. I mean, we're close enough to Salt Lake. We get people, I mean, almost all of our contractors or subcontractors are driving to the Wasatch back from the Wasatch front. We're having to compete with, you know, with employers on the Wasatch front. And why drive up the canyon if you can just get it locally? And then most of the folks who are driving to the Wasatch back to build are building luxury product and are getting paid more, right? So it's a challenge for us. One thing I think that's interesting is exploring methods, materials for construction that might reduce the amount of labor required. I think maybe there's a tipping point somewhere in the future. I don't think we've hit it yet, where the added cost of a more technologically based product or something that's got some prefabrication involved, where that cost is then less than the cost of the labor. Right now, I still don't see it. We've actually tried a few different things, some in collaboration with the University of Utah, in fact. And so far, the cost hasn't quite borne out yet, but I wonder if maybe that is a potential future for rural Utah and other rural areas elsewhere, where you have these labor shortages, difficulty of getting materials on site on time, and maybe you're looking at it makes prefabrication or other, you know, construction methods a little more viable over time. We'll see what happens there.
Very interesting. And we have a question from YouTube, and I would encourage everyone watching on YouTube, feel free to enter your questions in the comments. But this question from a student: how has the Opportunity Zone tax incentive affected investment in affordable housing in rural communities? Pat or Ben?
I haven't seen anything down here, but I might not be the best person to talk to. I think maybe our city and county leaders could better answer that.
Yeah. And in our service area, Summit Wasatch Counties, we don't have any Opportunity Zone areas that we work within.
That something that you think could help the development of more of those Opportunity Zones? Do you think that's something that could help rural Utah and that affordable housing?
I think it could. I think that it needs to be structured specifically for rural communities. I think what happens in towns like Park City or Moab is that you have, it's rural to be certain, but it's also this weird resort kind of urban, right? There's some urban aspects as well as some rural aspects. And so sometimes you're dipping into rural funds or, you know, monies or loan products or something that have been designed for rural communities. Those get hard to use once costs go to a certain point or something like that. And then on the Opportunity Zone, if those are more focused on an urban metro area style of development, it might be also similarly hard. So I'd say that I know that there are hundreds of other towns like Moab and Park City, Heber across the country, but I think that there could be more tailoring done to either Opportunity Zones or rural focused funds to make them work in areas where you have these high demand, lots of projected growth, and still having it be a rural area.
That was Pat Matheson, Executive Director of the Mountainlands Community Housing Trust. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, a panel discussion on Utah's booming real estate market and its impacts on rural Utahns. Here again is your moderator, Morgan Lynn Cotty.
Are there any models that other tourist destination areas in other states have used successfully in the past that could offer some guidance for the Utah situation?
Well, haven't had the opportunity to really study what other states have done. I know, or other resort areas, up, as I mentioned, Sun Valley, they did put in some employee housing, the resort. I talked to a few employees when I was up there a month or so ago and asked them how it was. And they said it's small and, you know, it's shared space. He had moved on and sharing with four other people down in town. One employer, the pizza place there that's really popular, they had the hiring sign out, and I asked him, well, how much are you paying? And he said, we're paying $18 an hour and $1,500 bonus for someone signing. And we've had two applicants and one didn't show up. He said, the issue is housing. People don't have housing, so they're not going to work up here because it's so expensive when you do find a place and you got to share. So I expect that this is the experience that we're having. You know, I've had discussions down in Kane County about this, over in Springdale, and of course what up in Summit County, and Ben's experience over in Grand. I don't know what it's like up in Rich, but it's pretty universal, I think, and there's a lot of common elements resorts across the West, the ski resorts. Maybe Pat can talk in greater detail. I know up in Summit County, they've done quite a bit employee housing. I think something like 1,000 beds. Is that right,
Pat? Yeah. There's a project going in at the canyon side of Park City Mountain Resort. 1,107 pillows is how they're counting it, or beds. I don't know if people are going to share a bed or something, but it's sort of more targeted toward your seasonal employee or maybe your shorter term employee, mix of townhomes to, dorm style units. And so they're really trying to capture that, help that part of the employee housing spectrum. I want to paint the context just a little bit from a policy standpoint. That's a win from Summit County, who worked with, the Canyons development and other developers there to get that done. And they required that they provide some employee housing. The employers, of course, are incentivized to do it. But I think that from a policy perspective, local municipalities can help put the screws to developers and push them to create housing solutions either on site or somewhere close by. Just a little context there.
I'll add just a little bit to that too. In Moab, one of the things that we face is that we don't have one of these big employers. Like, we don't have a ski resort. So we have kind of this little bit of a disjointed big business style. Like, we have the park service, we have, our local municipalities, things like that, but we don't have a big employer to be like, hey, if you're going to develop a ski resort, obviously you're going to have to develop 1,000 beds. I mean, that's just, that's the cost of doing business in a ski resort for sure. But what about a park service that only does 15, 20, 25 employees? Is that enough? Is that too much of a burden financially to put them under to make them, how much do you do? When you get down to these smaller numbers that Moab sees of being that kind of disjointed workforce where we have tourism and we have, USU coming in and we have these various different things, not just once localized, we got the river rafters and the bikers and, they're all kind of small outfits. How much do you require a small mom and pop shop is essentially what it is. How many units do you make them put in knowing that, hey, that's a small business that can't necessarily afford to build its own housing?
Right. And if they do, right, even if they are required to and do build the housing, what's the end result? As an example, a new sort of a small ski resort, I don't know if you can call it a ski resort, Woodward Park City. Woodward is where you skateboard and you do flips and stuff, break your neck. No, you don't do that. It's fun. Woodward was required to put in some employee housing. I think they put in 8 units right on site. They're just south of I-80. So it's interesting, right? The result there is Summit County pushed a smaller employer who doesn't have a whole lot of employees to produce housing on site. There's a local marketplace, Anaya's Market, that is relocating to a new place, and they have to do like 6 units, right? So, like, to your point, Ben, right? Someone whose main business is groceries or skate parks, right? Now they've got to do housing as well, right? And so it creates units, but what the end result is and how well those work inside of an entire community, it'll be interesting to see what those outcomes are.
That's so interesting. Thank you, everyone, for those perspectives. Shifting gears a little bit, I want to talk about sort of those bigger infrastructure needs that are necessary when, we see growth. So I'd love to hear you each talk about that infrastructure tie-in. What, in addition to housing and affordable rent and all these things that these communities need, what we're seeing in terms of sort of that hard infrastructure, water, roads, and also that soft infrastructure like daycare and those other things that people need to be able to work. Pat, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Water is going to be the limit on growth, it seems like. We have a whole lot of land in Summit County and Wasatch County. People don't want it all developed. And I think what's going to stop new development in some instances is going to be water. I think that what it's going to require is to rethink, and this is probably going to be a net benefit overall, is that we've got to find ways of developing that are less water intensive, take up less space, preserve wetlands and agricultural lands, so we can keep the water cycle healthy. So that sort of water infrastructure, and then also designing in advance of water shortages, is going to be critical. You mentioned daycare. The Park City Community Foundation a few years back did a survey of what the needs are in our community for just sort of a blanket, really general questions around needs. And the first two needs that came up in their survey of community members was affordable housing and affordable childcare. So those two things, I think, go hand in hand. I know that I have a little experience in Grand County. I'll let Ben talk to the childcare situation, but I think that it's something that everybody's facing, is how to provide affordable childcare. I'd say, water, obviously there's some communities where they don't have sewer, or, they're on septic or things like that. So I think there's some hard infrastructure there, but those are sort of, there's a cost to them, but there's a technical solution to them. I think that from a water standpoint, you can't just build your way out of it, because eventually we're going to run out of water. So we've got to learn to adapt to that rather than just build for more of it.
Thank you. Ben?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'd like to say that we kind of try to reverberate down here, and you probably have heard this before, is that we're trying to make housing one of the crucial infrastructure elements that people talk about when they talk about water and sewer and things like that. And that's fast becoming housing is infrastructure. I mean, that's what you need in order to, just like you need your sewer system, just like you need your roads. So that's one point that we're really trying to make down here to our elected officials and statewide. But more to your question, one of the issues that we face is we have this increase in need. Moab has a brand new sewer plant as of 2 years ago, which is great. But that new sewer plant has now increased all of our impact fees for all of our buildings. So we're kind of seeing a little bit of this like reverberating cycle of, yes, this impact is being allayed by this new infrastructure, this new sewer plant, but now all of our costs to build more housing is going up because our impact fees are going up. So we kind of see this kind of this vicious cycle. And just one more thing, again, in these small rural communities, we're not building 60, 80, 100 unit projects. We're building 20, 30, 40 unit projects. And when you get into projects that small, because our community is smaller and our population is smaller, it becomes a lot harder to put in those 20 miles of road or even a mile of road that a bigger project might be able to absorb, because they're going to have those rents coming in over the long term to be able to pay back a loan that helps you do that infrastructure. So we kind of get stuck in that, we need to do small projects because that's what investors like to see, because they want to make sure that they're successful. And on paper, Moab's just not a very big town. It's 6,000 population, but, double, triple that during the work season. But that on paper, that's not what our investors see. They see a permanent population of very few, even though the need is very great. It does end up being too anecdotal, on the ground, seeing what's happening, less of, okay, this is what I can actually put on paper, I guess, if that makes sense.
Thanks. And Jim, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, defining rural is always a problem. The census has more than one definition, and the state has tried to define it. And for this exercise, I took the five large counties, the four Wasatch Front counties, Weber, Davis, Salt Lake, Utah County, and Washington County, took them out of the data and looked at the population growth for the rest of the state from 2010 to 2020. And I was surprised. The growth rate for the rural area, the average annual growth rate was 1.6%. And for the five non-rural counties, it was 1.7%. And actually, the share of rural in 2010 and 2020 is almost identical. About 20% of the state is in those 24 counties. And the remaining five counties along the Wasatch Front in Washington County have about 80% of the population. But the rural area is experiencing growth, just like the urban area. And it is certainly an issue for their infrastructure, soft and hard, as its growth. You know, we're talking about an increase of 90,000 in population and in the rural area in the last 10 years. So, you know, and both Ben and Pat's area have seen more than probably higher growth rates than we see for all of the rural counties. And it's interesting, the rural counties as defined, if you look at Juab on the south end of the Wasatch Front, you look at Tooele on the west border of the Wasatch Front, and then you look at Box Elder, and those three counties are growing rapidly. People are commuting from those counties, the rural areas, into the Wasatch Front. And of course, Summit and Wasatch, they're outliers. They're crazy, the growth, both employment and in Summit County, you got a lot of employment growth, but the population growth is a little bit slower.
Yeah.
And that affects, you know, commuting times and air quality. And it's an issue where you have a lot of employment growth, but people got to commute in from Salt Lake or elsewhere. But so in the end, there's a lot of growth, and it's putting consistent with what's going on along the Wasatch Front, and it's putting pressure on the infrastructure.
Okay, we have one last question, then we're going to ask some of the questions from some of our students and staff and community members that are on YouTube. So if you haven't entered questions yet, please feel free to do so. But one question that I always think is fascinating is sort of that magic wand question. So if you could make one change to improve the situation with housing or availability, what would it be? But I sort of want to do this two ways. So if that magic wand you're asking, you know, those elected officials to make these changes, is there two paths? Are you asking those rural county commissioners or legislators for one thing, and maybe those state lawmakers for a different thing, or is it the same? So let's go in the order that we did previously. And now I've forgotten that order. So let's just start with Ben.
Well, my ask would be, like I was just saying, is to consider housing to be crucial infrastructure, just like you consider, you know, roads, bridges, sewer treatment plants, and things like that, and fund it appropriately. And I think the state, I'm not entirely privy on what I know that it's not enough on both the state and local level to address, you know, such a ongoing issue. And it seems like everyone wants to fund infrastructure for these hard infrastructure costs, you know, as money dollars are available. But starting switching that mindset a little bit and saying that housing is a crucial infrastructure for communities like Moab and Park City and things like that to make these businesses run, to make your communities run, you need to have places for them to house. And just like you need water to the house, you need a place for them to live.
Thank you. Pat, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with Ben. I would say that there's a funding component, and then there's a policy component about what is allowed to be built and what's the process for getting a project approved. If I could wave my magic wand, I would change the hearts and minds of voters and city and county councilors, where they would see a six-story building as a beautiful thing. I would be ran out of town if I propose, and I will someday propose a six-story building in the heart of Park City. And it's going to be brutal, right? It's going to be absolutely brutal. you know, what is a rural community? Well, it has this rural feel, and there's homes, and there's horses, and there's space, and there's mountains, and it's lovely. And of course, I mean, any planning student on the line knows this story, right? Well, we need to preserve our rural community and the rural feel, so we're going to keep building quarter acre lots and half acre lots, and pretty soon it's just a giant suburb, right? And so I think that the idea of the old Western rural town, as long as it's growing, is not viable. If it's going to keep growing and you want to still have those beautiful spaces that make Wasatch Back, Grand County, the whole state of Utah, what a beautiful place. If we want to preserve it, I think we got to go up. And I think we need to get dense and learn how to live together in tight places. So in addition to what Ben said about housing as infrastructure and funding it appropriately, I would also say, from a NIMBY aspect and from a, backbone of policymakers, we need to start getting dense fast, or we're going to run out of land and we're going to lose everything that we loved about this beautiful state. So I think the future is going to be different than the past, and we need to come to terms with that.
Thank you. Well, and you're giving yourself away with some of those plans behind you. It looks like you've got some three-story buildings back there. Yeah, so you just need to double it.
Yeah, that's right. Double it up. Yeah, this was sort of revolutionary. Four stories it was. Wow, four stories. That's pretty big, right? Right in the heart of the Snyderville Basin. So, I think we need to go up.
Okay, thank you. And Jim, what are your thoughts on that? What's your magic wand do?
Well, they've touched on... I think what's critical on the supply side, really, we don't have too much leverage. We can't change a labor situation or the cost, material costs. That's really hard for locals to have any leverage there. But in terms of planning, zoning, ordinances, and the time it takes for approvals, certainly that's would help the supply. If I had a magic wand, Morgan, what I would want to do is provide housing vouchers for those at 30%, state housing vouchers for those at 30% or less AMI statewide. It would require an ongoing source of funding, which is always a problem to get from the legislature. But we have right now in Utah, we have about 40,000 households, that's probably 120,000 people or more, who have incomes at less than 30%, 30% of AMI, which in Salt Lake County, you're talking about $25,000 for a family of four. They are spending at least half of that income on rent and utilities, and they receive no housing assistance. Those households, those 40,000 households, are on the edge of homelessness. Any kind of life-threatening event or automobile accident, domestic one, can lead to doubling up or, in some cases, to the shelters. I think the highest need, highest priority statewide is an issue, and it affects rural as well as the urban area, is to take responsibility for those that are really on the margin and are in greatest need of housing assistance. And the housing stress that those households face every day, it is just, it's really got to be difficult to wake up every morning knowing that half your income goes for housing. So if I had a magic wand, that's what I'd do. And at the same time, I'd want to find an ongoing source of funding for that, ongoing, that is preserved for that purpose. I've got some ideas on that, but I don't want to talk about it.
That was Jim Wood, Ivory Boyer Senior Fellow at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel answers questions from the virtual audience. Once more, here's your moderator, Morgan Lynn Cotty, Associate Director of the Hinckley Institute.
Okay, we have some great questions from our community who's watching, and two of them talk about sort of Zoom boom or the idea that this could be a bubble. So I'm going to try to combine both of them because I think they get to something that is on people's minds. So is there any indication that this is a bubble, that this is just sort of a Zoom boom bubble? Is there any indication it might behave like the 2008 crash? What are your predictions about this and the future trajectory of the housing market in Utah? And Jim, let's start with you. I'd love your perspective on this.
Okay, let me refer the viewers to our website, the Gardner Policy Institute. We published a study a couple of weeks ago, State of the State's Housing Market. And the very first issue we dealt with is, does Utah have a housing bubble? And we've certainly had a run-up in housing prices, and Utah is prone to run-ups in housing prices, acceleration. We led the country in a housing price increase in the mid-90s. We led the country in a housing price increase in 2006, just before the Great Recession. Right now, we rank second or third, depending between if you look at metro areas or if you look at states. We've had a 28% increase in the last year in housing prices in Utah, second only to Idaho. So again, we've had run-ups before. They don't all end up in housing bubbles. In order to get a housing bubble, and a bubble was defined some years ago by Alan Greenspan, what you need is a prolonged period of price decline, not price moderation or deceleration. You need actual declines in prices. So the run-up is the front end, and the decline is the back end of a bubble. So you really don't know if you have a bubble until after the fact. But are we going to have a prolonged period of price declines? If you look at Utah, every period where we had a run-up and then a moderation, when prices came down or decelerated, didn't decline, but decelerated, we had very weak job growth. That is not in the picture over the next 2 or 3 years for Utah. And could be fooled. Something might happen like, what happened with the Great Recession, but we don't see it right now. Secondly, the Great Recession was one of the principal causes was leverage. Leverage both in the global financial markets as well as households. We do not have that at this point. So that cause of the Great Recession and the bursting of Utah's housing bubble when we had 15 consecutive quarters of housing declines, not deceleration, but actual drop in prices. So that's what you need. And in Utah, we've only had one since the Great Recession, and that was in 2008 to 2012. Second quarter of 2012, we came out and started growing again in prices. So in my view, very unlikely that we have a housing bubble. I expect that in the next, maybe not in 2022, we're still seeing strong increases in housing prices. But I think we're going to see moderation in that last half of 2022 and then into 2023 and 24, particularly with the inflation and what that might do to interest rates. So I think we're going to see moderation.
Okay, fascinating. Pat, do you have any insights on that?
None to add to Jim Wood, my goodness.
I know, it's a tough act to follow. What about you, Ben?
Yeah. The only thing I'll add is in Moab, when Jim talked about the decline, or we never saw a decline. That was one of our issues, is that during 2008, 2009, 10, I think we were flat or we were increasing by 2 or 3%. We never saw a dip. So, we didn't get that correction. So we've been kind of steadily going upwards this whole time.
Okay. I think Pat will like this next question. So Pat, you plan on being the one to answer this one first. How can developers make dense development aesthetically appealing and livable and appealing to the community members?
Right. That's a great question. That's a great question. I think that it's right to put the onus on the developer to make it appealing. I think that at the end of the day, there's a value that is held generally by communities around density or height. And I think that no matter how beautiful the building is, I think that there is an underlying value system that needs to be interrogated and sort of poked and prodded and questioned. So I think that there is a lot of upfront work that needs to happen because you can, Paris, right? I think that most people would agree that Paris is a beautiful place. Paris is about six stories across the city, right? Gorgeous place. You can't take a Parisian building with its cute mansard roof and put it in Summit County. That would be weird. So just because it's a beautiful building doesn't change people's minds about how they feel about density or height. So how do we do that, and how do we address that? I think it's going to be a combination of pain points, right? Sort of like people taking transit, right? How do you induce people to ride the bus versus drive their car? Eventually, driving the car just becomes a pain in the rear and it's too inconvenient or expensive. And so people take the bus or the metro. So maybe there's a pressure point there. But then there's also just, questions around what it could look like. So I don't think that there's something we can do quickly to change how people feel about dense development and having more proponents of it. But I think it's in the long term something we are going to have to do in order to, keep this state a beautiful state and more sustainable. That wasn't a great answer, because I think that it's a long term game and it's about hearts and minds and not really about technical solutions. So.
Okay. And Ben, from your perspective, if we were to have more high density housing in Grand County, how do the residents of Moab, how do they make that pitch and make that appealing to them?
Well, one thing that Grand County and Moab hasn't done a ton of is this mixed use development of commercial and residential on the higher floors. I hope and pray that people would be more acceptable of this if you had a small grocery store at the bottom. Or if you had a coffee shop, or you had these more community felt, or these more inlet parks type of, not necessarily, but these mixed use developments that feel like it's not just a residential building, right? You could go there because you want to go there because you want to go to the coffee shop, or you want to go to wherever, to the gym that's newly constructed underneath this 4 or 6 story place, making it more a community atmosphere than a residential atmosphere. I think that's something that Moab hasn't done. I think that we need to delve into more. And I think that would help people's thoughts on residential development if they're going to a place that is, somewhere they want to go, like the gym, right? They want to go to the gym, but it just so happens that there's 5 floors of residential above it. And those can commingle, pretty well, I think.
And Jim, I know you're located here in Salt Lake City, but we even hear complaints about this and not in my backyard, that NIMBYism on the Wasatch Front. So what's your perspective on this?
Oh, Morgan. It is a long, as Pat said, it's a long process, and you do have to get to some pain points. We had our first legislation, HB 295 in 1997. That's when we had the run up in prices and led the country, and legislators heard from their constituents that we got a housing problem. And we're back to that point again now. The legislature is involved, but what we do need leadership at the state level, and that goes, starts with the governor, that this is such an important issue. That would help with the locals. They have a lot of, the power at the local communities, and the voices that are heard are those close to a development and might be affected by the development, but the voices that are unheard are those who are going to benefit they don't even know the project's being proposed, but it would benefit them. And that's one of the issues. You have this asymmetry of information out there on any new project. And I'm not quite sure how you work around that, but there, you know, I think we've made some progress in the last few years on that issue, but it is, as Pat said, it's a learning process and pain points.
Okay. And staying on that, and Jim, we'll start with you for this final question. Just looking back over the last few years and also looking ahead for the next few years, what has the state been doing to invest in affordable housing? And what do you see over the next few years? What will be the next actions that the state will implement?
Well, you frame that as what the state has done. Much of the activity or the support comes from the federal government. And then locals are also very important. The Fed has deferred to the locals on housing issues up until the last couple of years. And there's been discussion now in the legislature with SB 34, SB 39, and some work that they did last session. But, you know, they've done a lot on homelessness, and they spent something the state appropriated, I think, over $70 million now for the homeless issue and building new structures. What I'd like to see is, again, back to what I said a few minutes ago, is we talk a lot about supply. The other side of the equation is income, and we don't talk too much about that. Any economist will tell you probably the most efficient way to help is just to hand money, is to give, as I said earlier, a voucher to the really those most in need. But the state is, we had a conference last week, and we had an expert from Brookings Institution. She came and talked about other states' activities, policies, programs, and outcomes for affordable housing initiated at the state level. And I grabbed her after to talk to her about it, because we're going to maybe work on a study on that. And I said, give me some great examples. He said, there aren't any. The states don't really, they haven't done. California's done a lot, but she said it's so complex, nobody can understand it, and it is counterproductive. Oregon has done some over the last 40 years, but it's been an evolution of 40 years. You can't use them as a template. You're going to have to start your own, make it simple and direct. And that's what we need. And as I said, the state, the legislature now has their toe in the water, and I hope we can get knee deep soon.
Okay, Pat and Ben, do you have any final words about that as well? What you are hoping to see come out of the state in the next couple of years?
I'll just briefly say, I hope the state continues to encourage all towns and cities and municipalities to provide some affordable housing plan. There are some who don't have any, who need something. And I think that they could also benefit by, for lack of a better term, staying out of the way of those municipalities who want to be more progressive on it, and not punishing them or restricting their ability to do things like require inclusionary zoning of new developers and that sort of thing. I think there's some concern locally. I know some of the municipalities I work with that the state might, restrict the local government's ability to require affordable housing and new development. So sort of two answers there.
Thank you. And Ben, you get the final word.
Well, just something that is kind of more specific to Moab, and probably maybe not, but the issue we're seeing are housing availability creep up in the income scale. So, you know, I know that Utah Housing and definitely to Jim's point, there is absolutely a need for the 60% below, 30% below AMI housing, but also expanding that. And, you know, we're starting to run up into these issues where the police department can't hire and park service, you know, these are these like higher income you get two family members both making $40,000 a year. They're that missing middle is what we call them. They make too much to get out of our affordable housing programs. They can't qualify for our affordable housing programs, but they don't make enough to get something on the open market. And that's where us down here in Moab, we're trying to search for what's that. Where do we find the financing? Where do we find our different models that are in there for that 60% below, but how do you go higher than that? And that's one thing that we'll be looking to try to do.
That was Ben Riley, Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Southeastern Utah. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Winnowans Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.